Right. Everybody ready? All right, here's the next presentation called Mounting Discographic Catalogs on the Web, Examples from the Latin American Collection. And the two speakers we have here are both from the Indiana University Archives of Traditional Music. Suzanne Mudge is currently an assistant librarian and cataloger at Archive of Traditional Music at Indiana University. She received a musicology degree at the University of Minneapolis and a library degree here at Madison. She's also a performer of early music repertoire. Now, Emma, who just gave you her bio, and a good thing she did because I actually had written one up of my own. So if she hadn't showed up, I was going to read it. In fact, it was going to start out like, to know Emma is to love Emma. And to love Emma is to know Emma. No. But she gave me a better one. She's an electronic music resources librarian and reference librarian at Indiana University, William and Gail Cook Music Library in Bloomington, Indiana. So you're not really from the Archives of Music, are you? Okay, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It happens. That's all she gave me. I wish she'd given me more. But there she is. She's going to give you a wonderful little presentation along with Suzanne. And after that, we'll have our break. So take it away.
Thanks. Thank you. We didn't want to reveal too much about Emma all at once, so we're saving it. And we'll have a little bit more throughout the program. A couple of preliminaries before we get underway. First of all, maybe some of you haven't heard of the Archives of Traditional Music, which is at Indiana University. So afterwards, we've got a ton of handouts, and included in those handouts, there's a brochure about the archives, this one with the little red and black cover. And since we're going through the Hoagie Carmichael Centennial this year, I also wanted to publicize that a little bit. So we've got another brochure about the Hoagie Carmichael Collection, which is a pretty fascinating collection that we have at the Archives of Traditional Music. And again, before I get started, I just have to say it was great to see Ernie Kovacs. I just love that. I saw some as a kid, and it was wonderful. I don't think I got half of the jokes, but now I want to go back and try to get a video or something if I can. Anyway, thank you, Jim. Thank you very much for having us on the program. We're very happy to be here. And we feel we came to the right place, especially with the session on Hispanic discography yesterday, which provided the cultural context and musical examples for some of the repertoire in the collection we're discussing today. There are four parts to our presentation today, and I'll begin by starting at the end of the title, Examples from the Latin American Collection. Because the first thing we want to do is give you some background information on the collection, a sense of its contents. Most importantly, we want you to know about its existence. It's been buried way too long. And I'll just say right now, too, that if the packet of handouts, if we're short on handouts, we're going to have a sheet here, and we'll be happy to get handouts, any of the handouts, to any of you that want them. We'll make sure we send them to you. So I hope we're not too short in supply. Secondly, I'll explain briefly how we've processed the collection, the discographic catalog part of the title. Then Emma will discuss the web aspect and where we are with the project currently. The fourth part is asking for feedback and discussion from you. This is ongoing. We assume others will want to mount their catalogs on the web, and perhaps we can find a way to help save each other some time. Examples from the collection, acquisition. The collection we are discussing today, the Archives of Traditional Music's Latin American Collection of 78s, first came to the attention of Frank Gillis, archives director, former archives director, that is, in 1977, when K.H. Begley, B-E-G-L-E-Y, of Colonial Publishers in West Inglewood, New Jersey, sent an advertisement to the IU Folklore Institute stating that, "We've recently acquired, as part of the inventory of a small liquidated company, an exceptional collection of out-of-print and rare recordings of Latin American folk and popular music. We are advised that the collection is important not only for study and research in music, but also in such disciplines as linguistics, cultural history, ethnology, and sociology. The recordings, 78 RPM, are for the most part brand new. Some were recorded in the United States, all by Latin American performers, and many others in all parts of Latin America. Most Latin American countries and many musical forms are represented. I'm sorry to say that I don't have more information on Colonial Publishers. I posted a question once on the 78 list, but I really didn't get a response. I also don't know about the original owners of the collection. It appears that Colonial Publishers no longer exists, and if any of you have additional information on it, I'd really love to hear about it. And Frank Gillis, who has long since retired, was also not able to provide additional information. So we've got a bit of a mystery on our hands, but we've also got a very fine collection. And that's why we call it the Latin American Collection of 78s rather than naming it after an individual, because we really don't know who the original collector was. After examining the introductory offer of 10 discs, Gillis began a two-year effort to procure the $6,500 needed to purchase the entire collection of over 3,000 recordings. To my knowledge, and Louise Spear and anybody else who knows different, please correct me, but to my knowledge, the archives has never spent that much money acquiring a collection before or after this purchase. We rely on donations, so this was quite unusual. And Gillis took 2 years to get this money, as I said, so he felt the collection was very important for us to have. With the aid of IU faculty members, he convinced two departments at IU, which is no small feat, to provide the necessary funding. By November 1979, the archives began receiving shipments. 75 of the original recordings were broken during shipping. Begley sent 89 additional recordings to compensate for 23 for which he had no duplicates. The final collection count is 3,351, 78 RPM, 10-inch recordings. Description. In his letters to Frank Gillis, K.H. Begley stated that the collection spanned three decades from the 1930s to the late 1960s. Not surprisingly, only a handful of the discs include dates that are etched near the matrix numbers, and these are from the 1960s. There are approximately 380 different record labels represented in the collection. And Emma, could you put that first overhead up there? You've got this on your handout, your first one after the cover sheet, the tan-colored paper. This is included in our packet of handouts. There's a listing of all the record label names, and we're putting this overhead just in case some of you don't have the handout. So you can start to look through it and get a sense of it. There are two pages of it. While most of the recordings appear to have been recorded and manufactured in the United States, a large number of Latin American labels are also present, including Borinquen from Puerto Rico, Discomoda from Venezuela, Marvela from Puerto Rico, Odeon from Cuba, Peerless, which has been discussed at this conference before, from Mexico, and Sololux from Colombia. Major U.S. labels, notably Columbia and Victor, are also represented. In addition, there are extensive runs from particular labels, including Alegre, Ansonia, Mardi, Marvela, Muzart, Sico, Tico, and Verne. Yesterday, after the Hispanic discography session, Emma and I ran up to our room and checked the database because we wanted to see what we had in terms of Arlinda. I knew that we had some Arlinda holdings, and we did find that we have 52 Arlinda takes, so perhaps some of the ones that were not already discovered will be in this collection. I hope so. As Begley noted, the collection includes a range of genres from corridos, merengues, plenas, to boleros, and cha-chas. A partial listing of well-known artists includes Johnny Rodriguez, Davilita, Canario, Yo Montoro, Plácido Acevedo, and Pedro Flores from Puerto Rico, Bimbi and Celia Cruz from Cuba, Luis Quintero and Nelson Pinedo from the Dominican Republic, and Los Panchos, again mentioned yesterday, Tito Laura and Pedro Infante from Mexico. We have database reports in a three-ring binder that it's available for you all, any of you that are interested, that you can examine after the presentation. The reports that we have include a summary of the genres, the principal performers, that is to say the first and or second performer named on the label, and composers represented in the collection. We also have a complete printout of the database by company label numbers, which includes titles, principal performers, and composers. And finally, Emma was able to download the entire database on the laptop that we brought, so we should be able to answer pretty specific questions if any of you have them right after our talk here today. Access and cataloging. And I guess, Emma, did you get both sheets up there? Could you maybe put the second one up too, just so people can see it that don't have handout? Thanks. Since its arrival, public access to the collection has been limited. Despite good intentions, Colonial Publishers never completed a full and accurate inventory of the collection as they promised. The inventory they sent consisted of a non-alphabetized listing of record company names and numbers for the collection. Only 2/3 of their inventory included titles and principal performer for each recording. a concordance combining Old Colonial Publishers, the Old Colonial Publishers inventory, with the corresponding archive shelf numbers was created upon receipt. Nevertheless, title, performer, composer, and genre information was quite incomplete. The collection lay dormant at the archives until 1996, a little over a year and a half after my arrival there, when Marilyn Graff, longtime archives archivist of at the Archives of Traditional Music, brought the collection to my attention. This project became a personal one, since the collection had not yet worked its way to the top of the archives' list of priorities. By this time, Emma had worked at the archives as a visiting cataloger for another project. And I'll tell you a little bit more about her. Emma is not only from Puerto Rico, but she has also performed some of the repertoire represented in this collection. She's a violinist and a singer, and she has sung some of the songs that we have. So it was very exciting to be able to show this collection to her. Unfortunately, it was not difficult to get her to agree to collaborate with me on it. After we designed the database, which I'll discuss shortly, we decided to go to the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound in New York. We hoped to get a better sense of the time span for the collection. At the archives, we examined record company catalogs and Spanish language materials, promotional materials, and discographies. We were fortunate to have Sarah Velez, the archives' Latin American specialist, help us. During our short time there, we were able to determine that Begley was correct. The recordings do date from the 1930s to the 1960s. In fact, we found one early Victor recording dating from 1922. And I suspect there are other earlier recordings. There were a limited number of the catalogs available for us to look at. So we were very excited to find out that we did have earlier recordings, even though I think the bulk of the material is from the 40s through the 60s. Thinking these recordings might be somewhat unique as an institutional collection, we also checked the Regler Deutsch Index while we were at the Rodgers Hammerstein Archives to see if any of the five institutions represented by the index had some of the same labels. We found that Syracuse University not only has most of the same labels, but also that their collection essentially complements ours. In many cases, the gaps in a run for a particular label at one institution are filled by the other. I also suspect that the Rodgers Hammerstein Archives has some similar recordings, but the ones that we really found in the Regler Deutsch Index were from Syracuse. It was pretty exciting. The archives doesn't have the staff to catalog large collections with outside funding. Emma and I really wanted to get started without relying on outside funding. I use a member of the OCLC consortium, and the archives has a fair amount of experience cataloging jazz and popular recordings issued on 78 RPM discs, so we considered cataloging the records using OCLC. But as I said, this project was not a priority for the archives due to other projects that were already underway. So my time as the main archives cataloger had to be spent on other work. There was also the question of authority work. As many of you know, existing authority records for artists, performers, composers, lyricists, etc., named on 78 RPM discs is minimal, though it's improving. For Latin American artists, it is not very good at all. We didn't feel we had time to catalog this collection following our own standards, since the authority work would be extremely time-consuming. So we opted to create an in-house database and train students to do the data entry from the record labels. We decided to catalog the collection on FoxPro, which was at that time a university-supported database, though thankfully we were able to transfer data to Microsoft Access before the inputting was complete. As catalogers, we were reluctant to catalog each side of the disk instead of the disk as a physical unit, but for the ease of indexing and inputting, we decided to follow the Regler Deutsch model, adding additional fields. And I guess maybe you could put up the field, the database design there. So this is a sort of a simple overview that you also have in your handout of on the green colored paper. It's just a simple, and we can talk about it. I'm not really going to go into it at this point, but if people have questions, just want to give you a reference point. I did receive a small grant to hire an assistant to enter record label information in the database. We plan to create a print catalog for the collection following a performer discography model, specifically Spotswood Volume 4, where we would have an alphabetical listing of principal performers followed by a title listing with composers in parentheses of the performers' recordings in matrix number order. I don't know if that makes sense, but if you've seen Spotswood, you know what I mean. We plan to index the catalog by performers' names, composers' names, titles, genres, record label numbers, and matrix numbers. As with other archives' commercial holdings, the archives' technical staff will end up making duplicate in-house listening copies on request. That brings us to the present. All the steps in the process of getting the collection cataloged took longer than we had hoped, not a surprise, I suppose. The database is complete, but still needs some cleanup. We have not created a print catalog yet, though, as I said, we have printed out a rough copy of the database, which includes most of the fields. And as I said, you're also welcome to examine that after our talk. We have decided that to increase accessibility and use our efforts should focus on mounting the database on the web. Meanwhile, during the time we were inputting record label data, members of the Society of American Archivists were, and had been for some time, developing a standard for describing the structures of an archival finding aid for paper-based collections using standard generalized markup language, SGML. The standard became known as the Encoded Archival Description, EAD, for a document type definition, DTD. As Emma will explain, there are various options available for converting data from a database to mount it on the web. It appears that some institutions are adapting the EAD structure. We know that there are plans to mount the American Vintage Record Labelography, including the Wrigley Deutsch Index and the large Altschuler collection at LC. We don't know what process they plan to follow. I'm not clear, but I think they may be converting to the MARC format first. The central question we're asking today is, do we, that is to say, any of us who have discographic catalogs, do we modify EAD for sound recordings or develop a separate standard? Emma will now discuss the SGML model we are working on. We look forward to discussion, feedback, and suggestions. The standard will take a long time to develop, but if that process begins, there's no group better suited to provide input than ARSC when the time does come, if it comes. Before Emma begins, I do want to mention one other thing in the handout, and that we have a URLography, as we call it, and I don't know if other people call it that, a list of URLs at the end of your handouts. And some of those are really quite good. We tried to select the ones that we thought were the most helpful in discussing some of the acronyms that we're talking about today. So thank you, and Emma, it's all yours. Oh, yeah. Well, I guess we need a little transition before we get into the technical part. So would you introduce the piece for me?
Some examples from the collection, and we have a recording. The title is La Pipa de Cachucha, and it's a plena, a genre from Puerto Rico. It's performed by one very well-known performer from the island, Jomo Toro, and Nieves Quintero with his ensemble. Let's hear.
Pipa y chupa que chupa, y ahora se pasa la noche galando pipa y chupa que chupa.
Chupa que chupa y chupa, chupa que chupa y chupa, chupa que chupa y chupa, pa' que vacile como cachucha. Chupa que chupa y chupa, chupa que chupa y chupa, chupa que chupa y chupa, pa' que vacile como cachucha.
Tu marido don Cachucho ya cuesta con mucho miedo, no quiere pasar un susto si la cama le coge fuego. No quiere pasar un susto si la cama le coge fuego.
Chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, pa que vacile con lo cachucha. Chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, pa que vacile con lo cachucha.
Cachuchita se marea y te pone sabrosita cuando ve que todo voltea. Te pone sabrosita cuando ve que todo voltea.
Chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, pa' que vacile como machuca.
cachucho con el cachimbo y con la pipa cachucha. Si no dejan este vicio van a morirse chupa que chupa. Si no dejan este vicio van a morirse chupa que chupa.
Chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, chupa que chupa chupa, chupa pa' que la tire como una chucha.
Item 16.
Well, we're having a little bit of difficulty with the balance between the projector and the computer, which was working not too long ago. As always, technology is very temperamental. As Suzanne Much was mentioning, I became in contact with this collection in 1986, 87, while being a cataloger at the collection for a Somalian sub recording at the archives. And it was interesting while I was trying to do my job and catalog a Somali collection, I kept wondering what happened with the Latin American collection that was sitting right next to me. But I had to comply with a grant that the reason I had the job is because the grant was asking for cataloging the Somalian sound recordings. And during that time, Susan and I talked about the collection, and I became very excited to know that Indiana, a place that I was adopting as a new home, had such jewels of Latin American music in their collection. I said, well, this is definitely a place I can live in now. And I started wanting to listen to some of them, but of course, due to the preservation issues and the playback of 78, I couldn't get my hands on it, even though I worked there. And Suzanne said, well, we need to collaborate in a project and do something, and then when we have the right format, then you can listen to them. So luckily, we have been able to tape a few samples, but mainly the whole collection is still only on 78. It's not playable at this time. After we worked on the database in Microsoft Access when it was transferred from Foxpro, just because it was an easier program and it was becoming the new program supported by IU, I realized that this was, I didn't want to spend too much time developing this database because the information was so scattered and so it needed so much authority work that we decided, okay, just have the student input the data just as it is on the label. And from then on, we can, in the future, once the whole collection is in the database, then we can figure out what to do with the collection. Either publish a catalog, and being a technological person myself, I just try to get access and put it available through the web for people to find it and see what we have. And at that point, it's when I started doing a project on SGML and decided that this was the way I wanted to pursue with this collection, since we want two goals, one to publish it on the web, and the second one to publish a catalog. And we didn't want to go through all the trouble of trying to figure out the two different formats and the display and the layout. At that point, I made a proposal to Suzanne to try to come up with a DTV for discographical formats based on other DTVs like the EAD and the TEI, which is the Text Encoding Initiative, and the archival encoding initiative. At this point, I'll try to put up the presentation and hopefully it will work at this time. It's not displaying correctly, but I'll just go through it and I'll read what I have on the screen. First, what is SGML? We have a standard generalized markup language that was developed around 1995-96, and it's been widely implemented, and you may not know it, but you've been seeing it in many different applications, including the Encarta Encyclopedia that is on CD-ROM. And many CD-ROM products are using SGML as their way of designing how the document is going to be controlled and displayed. The title of the standard is International Standard ISO 8879. SGML is a set of rules for defining and expressing the logical structure of documents, enabling software products to control the searching, retrieval, and structured display of documents. The reason that attracted me the most was if we wanted to put this collection on the web, I wanted to have really defined control access point, because being a reference librarian and having to help our users, we wanted to have targeted searches to be the way of accessing the collection, instead of just browsing through a whole text file of data. It encourages consistency by introducing the concept of a document type definition, and I'll get into what that is a little bit later. Both standard and generalized, so it's a standard, but it has a lot of flexibility in it that you can use and manipulate to provide the output that you're trying to come up with. There's no non-existent off-the-shelf product that you can say, okay, I'll use this to mark up my data, and then it will be already set up. All the products have been developed because of specific projects like this one. And that's the way people want it. They want it to be able to customize what they're doing with the programs. The part of an SGML document is the SGML declaration, the document type definition, which I'll be getting into pretty soon, and the document instance. The declaration, which is the markup declaration, contains elements. And if you see the example that I have on the yellow sheets, it has the elements divided of what elements compose a discographical unit. And at this level, we are at the song unit. I just put an example of the song level, which has the elements that we have in our collection. I have to remind people that this was based on this particular database as an example, with the aims and goal of expanding the structure to include broader discographical units. So at the song level, we have in-house numbers and the matrix number, of course, the title, parallel title, names, which includes the performer, the composer, the secondary performer, and performer notes and composer notes that we have in the database. The publication information, recording information, and a notes field, which actually we use a lot to put miscellaneous information we couldn't fit in other areas. It includes attributes, which is a description of the elements or control for the elements. And I have an example of the song, of genre being used as an attribute for the song at this particular part of the collection, but it may well change and become an element in itself. Since we have so many genres, it will be a little bit too cumbersome to try to come up with a listing of genres that will be simple enough for the student doing the inputting to select which genre is the one that he has in his listing. So that's the flexibility. You can either use it as an attribute or make it an element in itself, and then it has all the different control that you can program with. Then it has entities, which is just a way of eliminating duplication by grouping different repeated elements, like titles. You could have a title under the song, the title of the recording, the title of the subtitles. You can conglomerate all those elements and it will become an entity. The document type definition is the part that I'm most interested in, and is the part that I will be asking and welcoming your comments on for later on. It's what actually describes and defines the structure of what this discographical database or catalog should look like. And I know there was a conversation, very good conversation going on this afternoon, and it's interesting to see that we were put in the same program, because definitely it will be something that we will be following pretty closely and keeping our eyes on. So the document type definition, what it does is just tells the computer what to expect in the document, that there will be a title, there will be a publication information, etc. It encourages consistency. By having this document, you can just have a set of rules whenever it's doing your database or inputting the data. They know where the following elements are going to go because they're already set and defined. And it expresses in SGML as a set of declarative statements, and the statements, each statement starts with an ampersand and an exclamation point, and it has a closing ampersand. I have a SGML and a DTD example, and the DTD example, the way it looks on an open editor, I have here an element I again put as an example the song as the element, and it has this, the element statement, which says that the song has a song ID, a matrix number, the title, the parallel title, etc. Then you have to describe the different elements, how at which level the element become data, or is it still having descriptive tagging. And you have an example on your handouts on this. Then this is what it will become from the DTD. It becomes an SGML declaration, and that's pretty close to what you see on HTML on the web at the moment. The declaration just have the tags that have been defined by the DTD. And at this point, I define the accession number as ACNO. And this is actually an example from the collection. This is an in-house number, so it has the 79880543, which is the accession number, the shelf number, etc. So it's a hierarchical structure. It just starts from the top level and it goes down, telling you what, how conglomerated you have the elements and the attributes. This is the title level of the example. And the good part with this, one thing that is very flexible is that this is not how it displays. This is only how it's encoded. So the SGML only tells you how to describe the document. How the document is going to look is up to anyone. We can have a DTD that is manipulated by performers. If you want to come up with a performer discography, that can be manipulated in a way that all you have to do is say the performer will be the primary, the upper level of the encoding, and then reconfigure the elements to follow the performer as the primary entity for sorting and indexing. So it's very flexible. It allows you to manipulate the data in many ways. And you don't have to worry about output and display, just about how, until another level. I mean, at the beginning, you just worry about what's needed for the document type definition to work. And then from then on, anyone can come up with a presentation layout. And this is just following the same example, the publication level and the recording information. And then again, there's things missing, like we will have duration, but our collection doesn't have duration at all. There was no duration information, so it's not included in this layout. The document instance is just the markup text, just those three files that you saw. It's the file as a whole, which has each element that is included must be explicitly marked or tagged in some way. If the element is not marked, it's not going to be accepted. It's not going to be part of the document. The advantages is a descriptive markup language. It's descriptive enough that you can play with it instead of having to conform to already developed tags for other formats. It's on the public domain, which means it doesn't have any dependence to any hardware or software, which is one attraction if you want to share information with other people. The flexibility is very portable. It's cross-platform data exchange. And the format specification allows the reuse of encoded data for multiple output purposes. And that's one of the features that attracted me in coming up with this design, is that we could use it for the database, we could use it for the catalog, and we could use it to create separate indexes without having to worry about redesigning the two or three different aspects that we want to products that we want to come up with. It's a standard, so it's easy to integrate, and it's widely adopted. There's, as I said, Encarta, Microsoft is using it for all the help programs that you're using. When you need to use the help guide on a software program, chances are that it's been designed on SGML. Many companies are using it for having their staff do their input on SGML, and that way they ensure that if the company has a branch in New York and a branch in London, they're doing exactly the same thing. They can assure that it's portable and they can share information that way. It's a hierarchical structure, but it doesn't necessarily need to be used as a hierarchical structure. I mean, you can use it as a flat structure if you don't use the AID browser or other browser that is mainly hierarchical in concept. The structural approach helps being able to specify each element with a unique tag and identifier helps designing search capabilities, and specific elements can be searched and retrieved very efficiently. If you, I don't know how many of you use the web at this moment, but if you try to do searches on the web, you can see that it's a little bit of a nightmare if you don't have a control vocabulary or structure in the web. Some of the disadvantages, and some of these have been overcome, some still hanging around, is HTML documents delivered through the web need a helper application to be readable, and I have a listing on the handout that you have at the end. The purple handout has a listing of some of the applications that are on the market for these purposes. Many people that are doing projects with HTML, what they're doing is after they do the project, they translate the HTML coding into HTML, and that, but still it's already structured, so all you have to do is get an indexing program and it will make use of your HTML information to do searches. So that's why we're looking at it. I mean, I know having to depend on external applications is not the way to approach the most common people, but there's possibilities and ways around it. And if I don't know if you've seen the Duke Sheet Music Collection, they have a beautiful example of the EAD DTD application, which is translated into HTML, and they have the database online for searching purposes. Standardization, again, as in any computer and technology project, is always an ongoing process. I mean, you never get it perfect. Once you're getting it perfect, you have to move on to the next technological attraction. And but this one has been around for quite a while. There's a lot of people using it, as I said, and there's already being implemented quite widely in many different library projects. So it's a standard that by itself seems to be portable enough into whatever is coming up. That was the main goal when it was being developed, is portability and not dependable on anything that is current as hardware and software. The future, we're already seeing XML application, which is extensible markup language. It's not a language by itself, it's more of a derivative of HTML. And some people, what they're doing is doing their HTML projects and just translating them into XML, which seems to work very, very, very transparently and very easily. And Microsoft and Netscape are already planning XML support for the next browser, the next version of their browsers. So as you can see, there's already plans of integrating this concept into the browsers. The development of HTML helper application inherent in the browsers instead of the helper applications now that you have to bring up when you see the HTML document. So before you couldn't see images on the web, now you can because there's an inherent application that knows how to read GIFs and PEGs and all the image formats. It should be the same with HTML and that shouldn't be too far from now. What is needed for implementation? The DTD documentation is very important, and that's the part where all the experts in different areas of the field need to contribute their expertise. The DTD wouldn't work if it doesn't serve the purpose of those that need it. The tag library needs to be defined in a way that will comply with many different users and the way they develop their discographical units. And it needs an application guidelines. After all, the elements are described and put together, then somebody there needs to be guidelines on how they're going to be used so we all use them in the same way and then information can be shareable. The important steps for success, we need input from interested groups, and I'm saying we, and I'll explain a little bit that is not we what I'm trying to say. When we're coming up with this project, and next week, one of the person that is very involved at IU with the HTML is meeting with the people that invented the EAD, the encoding archival description, and the DEI in a computing meeting that they're having, I think in Washington. And he's going to present this proposal to those experts on the HTML field and see what can we come up with to make databases available that can be cross-searchable independently of where they are located. And of course, there will be the technological part of it, but still we need the people that do develop and work with discographical units to provide the expertise of what's needed in the DTD. So, and that's what I have here. The content model experts are the most important part of a successful DTD description, and that includes the discographers and the librarians, in both in reference and cataloging departments. The technical experts, which are the computer experts, are already being approached. Hopefully, they will agree. And the institutions and associations like ARCS, MLA, and YAML will be a good way to make sure that if you're developing a standard, that everyone has their input and saying on it, since it's supposed to serve everyone's. The users, of course, are an important aspect, even though we try to ignore them sometimes. hopefully we don't. We should observe the ways they're researching and what needs. And for that matter, librarians and discographers are users on themselves when they're doing research for their own products and developments. So we can all provide input and come up with something that is more easily available. One way we're trying to work with, and we're already approaching this concept, is by working with already developed EAD and DTD products. And the MARC format is, of course, our bibliographic DTD in itself. And the EAD, I already mentioned that the person from the Indiana University, Perry Willett, from the Letters Department, is going to be talking to the EAD developers and the TEI in 2 weeks. And the discographical standards and guidelines, and already we saw the beginnings, or not the beginning, but some approaches to those guidelines to be developed and established. The naming conventions and the data structures should be used whenever possible, so we're trying to watch all those standards to make sure that if there's an element that we can use to describe what we're trying to describe, to use it instead of coming up with a new one. That way we are ensuring that whatever we do have a better longevity instead of being proprietary and don't gain too much support from computer programmers. This is just an example of how what I presented as the DTD description will translate into the already developed EAD. And I don't think you can read it very well, but it's just mentioning the tags that seem to be correspondent to what's already available. And there's a lot of similarity with what is already available in the EAD DTD and what I have come up with from our database and my observations of discographical units. And that's just a continuation at the song level. And what's next, I already mentioned the communication with the developers of encoding archival description and TEI, and this meeting here with professional discographers and experts on the field. And in a month or so, we should be getting together at IU and try to see how we can put all this together and start communicating through the different associations and try to get the people involved. This is just a little mention of some of the tools that are needed for an EasyGML system. And there's a parser, which is a little program that makes sure that the data corresponds to the DTD description. And what it does is it goes through the different elements and determines whether the element is repeatable or just is supposed to be there or not. And if it's there, okay, it goes to the next level. If it's not there, then it says you were supposed to have this, so I'm not going to accept this piece of information until you modify it to comply with the DTD. SGML editors, some people think that you have to buy an already developed. There's some commercially developed, but you can also use WordPerfect 8 or Notepad or any text editor to come up with manipulating the SGML and the DTD. There's a formatting software that is used just for changing information and displaying it as either HTML or XML or whatever standard language do you want to use. And the browser, I said, it has to be SGML compliant, and there's Panorama, there's SoftQuad Panorama, and there's Multidoc, but I don't, otherwise you have to download information and then read it in a different program. So.
Thank you, Emma.
We do have about a minute for maybe a question or two. Mark Tollison.
Exactly. We've been looking at the MART tag to be included. There's a lot of information that is the model of this will be based on the MART tag, definitely, because we are librarians and we are catalogers. We know that's the right way to go. The reason it's not being done that way is a lot of information missing, and we're looking into coming up with the next step for the project will be to include the sound files and the images of the labels into the database. So. That also included, we were hoping to have more of a hierarchical pathfinder type of thing inherited in the development of this particular project. That doesn't mean of the DTD, but it will be closely watched and followed to make sure that we use those tags whenever possible. And that's the part that I was mentioning before, to make sure that to comply with those tags.
Virginia?
Mm-hmm. We've actually made a digital finding aid for two field collections, and we have image files and audio files for them that were awaiting the SNL standards to complete, so that the finding aid itself will actually show you the field of and present you with the audio file simultaneously. And I really like your project really well, and it would be a good general and very well for our institution too, so if you could go for it, we're looking at this technology, if you could really collaborate. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the collaboration will be the key issue and the secret to success.
Mm-hmm. One more question, then we'll wrap it up. That's it.
Not because XML, as I said, is not a language in itself, so it's still dependent on SGML and other applications. Of course, when they were developing the EAD, they were watching very closely the XML, so there's a lot of elements already included, so that shouldn't be a problem. There will be a switchable approach because it's easier to use, so whatever, by bringing this to the EAD developers and the Library of Congress and people that have already worked with SGML and DTD and XML, they will make sure that that's already being implemented in the development, so that shouldn't be a problem. But you're right, I mean, it's easier to use.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you, Emma. They'll both be around on the break, and I'm sure for most of the day, rest of the day, if you want to ask questions, just grab them. Lunch or breakfast or what do you call it? Break. I'm drinking. Don't worry about it. Outside, out front, enjoy 15 minutes or so, then get back in here for the rest of the program. Thank you.